Just a quick word before we get going. Our merch store is being launched soon and we are looking for someone to manage it. If you're interested in helping out, please hit me up on Facebook or Twitter and let me know. You'll find details of all of our social media profiles in the show notes. Let's get into it.
A Cry Most Queer is an LGBTQ true crime podcast based in Johannesburg, South Africa. Intended for adult audiences and may contain graphic or disturbing content, including detailed descriptions of violence, physical or sexual assault, injuries to victims, and foul language. If you feel this may trigger you at all, please reconsider listening. If you need to talk to someone, please see our show notes for the contact numbers of crisis helplines around South Africa.
Welcome to A Cry Most Queer. I'm NJ Hawkeby. In our final installment of our series on gay panic in South Africa, I want to discuss, arguably, one of the greatest miscarriages of justice carried out against the South African queer community I have come across thus far. And this in a country where a mass murderer is being considered for early parole. And if you haven't yet signed the petition against this, stop whatever you're doing and go to the link in the show notes. Okay, so details on today's case are sketchy at best, with no written record of the sentencing, and only one court reporter having been in court on the day. But I've done the best I could with the sum total of just five news articles I could find. Fair warning, this case is short, but never fear, I won't leave you hanging. I also talked to Roche Kester, the hate crime manager at Out LGBT Wellbeing in Pretoria, regarding South Africa's history with the gay panic defence, so stick around for that in the second half. But without further ado, let's get into Gay Panic in South Africa Part 3, The Assault of Sududuzo Buthelezi. As the sun rose over Chatsworth, 15 kilometres south of Durban, residents made a shocking discovery. There, next to a river, they found the body of a local businessman, Sududuzo Buthelezi. The only visible evidence of any injuries was bruising on the front right side of his neck, and his car was nowhere to be seen. It would take almost 2 years for this case to get to trial, but when it did, it would send shockwaves around the world, despite the lack of coverage. In 2017, Sududuzo approached a company on the south side of Durban to have car stickers designed for his business. There, he met Nkosinathi Mdlala, a 25-year-old graphic designer working for the company. The two worked quite closely together through the design process, and then one evening, at the end of the workday, Sududuzo offered Nkosinathi a lift home, and the two men left together. On their way, they stopped for a drink at a local pub. One drink led to many, until eventually Nkosinathi said that they should call it a day. Sududuzo wasn't in the best state to drive, so he handed his keys over to Nkosinathi, claiming that he didn't know the area, and climbed into the passenger seat. Nkosinathi got behind the wheel and pulled the car out of the parking area, heading in the direction of Higginson Highway, as that would be the road that Sududuzo would need to take home, and he didn't need his intoxication playing havoc with a sense of direction. Coming from Durban myself, I can vouch for the city being confusing enough to navigate without adding alcohol into the mix. Now, my uncle once said, alcohol is a window on the truth. And it's one of the truest things I've ever heard. If you are, deep down, an abusive, aggressive arsehole, this is exactly what comes through when you're drunk. Similarly, if you are caring and lovable, alcohol tends to make you overly affectionate, sometimes inappropriately so. It's very possible that Sududuzo was the latter, caring and lovable, and that he had, up to that point, kept his attraction to Nkosinathi to himself. However, being a little pickled could have quite easily lowered his inhibitions, and, with Nkosinathi driving, Sududuzo's hands could have wandered. This is apparently what happened, although as there were only two of them in the car, we will never know for sure. What follows is entirely Nkosinati's story. That's all we have to go on. Nkosinati's story, as relayed by the daily news' Sne Musuku, the lone court reporter who happened to be in court the day Nkosinati went before Judge Shyam Gyanda. Nkosinati claimed that while he was driving, Sududuzo began rubbing his hand up and down Nkosinati's thigh. He then started caressing Nkosinati's beard and suggested that the two become lovers. Nkosinati claimed to have apologized for giving Sududuzo the wrong idea, but then the drunk man leant over and kissed him on the chin, and Nkosinati pushed him away. Sududuzo fell back into the seat and began to laugh. It's not known whether the laughter was mocking or embarrassed, because Nkosinati never explained the tone of the laughter. But he did say that the laughter and Sududuzo's actions had him feeling embarrassed and humiliated, quote-unquote. And he swung his left arm blindly in Sududuzo's direction, landing the blow on Sududuzo's neck. Sududuzo slumped back against the passenger door and went silent. Three times Nkosinati called out his name, but Sududuzo never replied. Then Nkosinati glimpsed the man's face. His eyes were open and blinking with a glazed look about them. Nkosinati stopped the car and shook Sududuzo vigorously, but eventually he had to concede that the man was dead. He had killed Sududuzo Buthelezi. Nkosinati panicked and drove around for a while as he tried to decide what to do. Any ordinary man would have driven to a hospital to try and get them to resuscitate Sududuzo, or a police station to hand himself over and explain that it was an accident, but not Nkosinati. Instead, he dumped the body near a river where, in his own words, it would be found. Then he got his friend to dispose of Sududuzo's car. Sidebar. What is it with murderers dumping bodies near rivers in the KwaZulu-Natal? The circumstances surrounding the police investigation and Nkosinati's subsequent arrest never made it into the media, save for a single line in the source article for every other report on the case, that the friend who was found in possession of Sududuzo's car led the police to Nkosinati. So let's jump ahead to the court proceedings. Please note that I never said trial. That would be to give the joke that was the prosecution of Nkosinati Buthelezi serious delusions of grandeur. In February 2019, yes, you heard correctly, 2019, what you're about to hear all went down only 2 years ago. Anyway, in February 2019, Nkosinati pleaded guilty to culpable homicide in the Durban High Court, with Judge Shyam Gyanda presiding, Advocate Denito McDonald representing the state, and representing Nkosinati? Well, wouldn't you know it, our old friend Hyacinth Malotra, the same legal aid attorney who, back in 2013, represented Mbulelo Nkosana, who we met in part one. I told you he'd be turning up again. Stick around. It gets better. Back to the pre-sentencing hearing. As mentioned, Nkosinati pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of culpable homicide, which doesn't carry a minimum prescribed sentence in South Africa. It may be interesting for some of you to learn that we don't have premeditated murder here in South Africa either. Murder is murder, regardless of whether you planned it in advance or not. Premeditation only comes into play once guilt has been proved and we get to the sentencing stage. Anyway, in his plea explanation, Nkosinati laid out the events of that day in 2017, as already discussed, saying, quote, I admit that I ought to have foreseen the possibility of him dying as a result of being hit in the neck, end quote. The forensic pathologist's report confirmed that the cause of Sududuzo's death was either blunt neck trauma or mild strangulation, which corroborated how Nkosinati said Sududuzo had died. Prosecutor Denita McDonald admitted that, as there were only two people in the car that night, it was impossible to know what actually happened, and that the court could well accept Nkosinati's version of events, but, he argued, Nkosinati's actions were criminal. A man had died. However, Nkosinati's attorney, Hyacinth Malotra, asked that the court consider that his client had pleaded guilty and taken the court into his confidence. After all, the murder wasn't premeditated, and he was acting in self-defense against an unsolicited advance. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that what Sididuzo did was acceptable, or that Nkosinati defending himself against sexual assault isn't an appropriate response. And I also accept that the human body is a fragile vessel. So it's not inconceivable that Nkosinati was telling the truth when he said that he had no intention of killing Sididuzo. But dumping the body? And asking his mate to get rid of the car? That's suspicious. Be that as it may, however, suspicious or not, Nkosinati was convicted of culpable homicide. Remember, a charge with no minimum prescribed sentence. And the court moved to sentencing. Now, as mentioned, there was only one reporter in court that day. But the article she published shocked the community, both here in South Africa and abroad, to its core. It was so shocking that the story was carried on South Africa's Mumba Online and Daily Maverick, and on Percolately, which is part of George Takei's Oh My Network, the New York Daily News, and Newsweek. According to Ms. Masuku, during sentencing, Judge Gianda rejected the state's recommendation that Nkosinati be jailed for, at the very least, a short period of time, basically taking Nkosinati at his word due to a lack of witnesses. But that wasn't the shocker. The shocker came when Judge Gianda told Sididuzo that he had reacted in a way that any other person in his situation would have. Now, as mentioned, there's no written record of the sentencing available, and judges aren't always required to provide written reasons for sentencing. But when contacted by Rebecca Davis of the online publication The Daily Maverick to confirm that there was no way Masuku could have been mistaken, Masuku assured Davis that her paraphrasing of Judge Gianda's words were faithful to the meaning and tone of his utterances. The only thing that sort of explained Judge Gianda's leniency was when he said, quote, "You are a first offender. The state had suggested a short prison term to pay for your actions, and thereafter a correctional supervision term. In my view, this would not help, but would expose you to further criminality." End quote. He then gave Nkosinati a suspended sentence of 10 years, meaning that he would not see the inside of a prison cell unless he reoffended in the next 5 years, and also sentenced him to anger management classes and 3 years of community service at 40 hours a month. Essentially, a standard work week every month. Because, yeah, that all seems like a fair punishment for taking another man's life. In the wake of the sentence, the Twitterverse went apeshit. Isaac Kgavela tweeted, quote, "Hectic. I understand it's self-defense and lacks intention to kill, but he disposed the body." End quote. Mafuza Maya tweeted, quote, "The judge took his word because there was no witness. This is not justice." End quote. Sindiso Mulman went as far in her tweet to recommend a more acceptable punishment, tweeting, quote, "I think at least 4 years prison time would be fair. The man killed a person. This is not a fair sentence at all." End quote. Tweeps Nkosi and Yas Blanchet were more succinct in their criticism, with Nkosi tweeting, quote, "Aye, this is wrong," end quote, and Yas merely saying, quote, "That's bad," end quote. Masterpiece understatement there, bud. Queer organizations across the country also came out strongly in their criticism. In a statement to Mumba Online, Mwadi Swartz, the paralegal officer at Pretoria-based Out LGBT Wellbeing, condemned the inappropriate sentence, saying, quote, "The leniency of the sentence is discouraging to efforts to bring justice to the LGBTQIA+ community. The sentencing concretizes the general feeling that the justice system has failed the community by not promoting their protection and right to justice." End quote. And Matthew Clayton of the Triangle Project in Cape Town said that his organization was appalled at the sentence, considering that Nkosinati had tried to cover up his crime by dumping Sididuzo's body and hiding his car. Nkosinati has vanished into obscurity. Having a popular name seems to help, because a quick social media search turned up a number of results for Nkosinati Mudlala around KwaZulu-Natal. So, while Sididuzo's friends and family have been deprived of their loved one, with little to no justice for the person they lost, Nkosinati gets to carry on with his life without the world being aware of his past. Or does he? Hold that thought. There is one last twist in this tale. Remember Hyacinth Malotra, the legal aid attorney who represented both Nkosinati and Bulelo Nkosana 4 years earlier? Both cases where variations on the gay panic defense were floated, and at least in Nkosinati's case, essentially got him off with a slap on the wrist. Well, at the end of 2019, Mlotra was renamed Legal Aid Lawyer of the Year, with Vela Mdaka, Legal Aid's provincial executive, saying that the winners at that year's award ceremony, including Mlotra, had made Legal Aid SA proud. Maybe I'm being a little overly critical, and I'm not denying that Mlotra may be a good lawyer. But any lawyer who can stoop to putting gay panic forward as a defense, not once, but twice in just 6 years, thereby giving the public the impression that beating someone to death because he came onto their client sexually, regardless of whether the defense actually works out for his client or not, shouldn't even be in the running for Lawyer of the Year, especially not in the same year that he managed to get the court to essentially condone the offense. I did try to secure an interview with Advocate Mlotra back in late January, but after 3 phone calls and an email, I finally got an emailed response on February the 1st, riddled with spelling and grammatical errors, which read, quote, "Hi, I've noted the contents of your email, I will get back to you tomorrow," end quote. I responded to that mail, but as of this recording on the 1st of April, I haven't heard anything further. And that brings us to the end of today's case, but we're not done. I'll be back with my chat with Roche Kester from Out straight after this. So, with the amazing response I received following my interview with Lee Fisser last week, I decided to introduce a new, for now irregular, segment where I speak to people from the community on the topic of the week. This week, I'm chatting to Roche Kester, the Hate Crimes Manager from Out LGBT Wellbeing in Pretoria, an organization that offers health and legal services to the South African queer community, because I wanted to find out how prevalent gay panic is in the legal system of South Africa, and to what extent it is a problem or concern for our community. Roche, thank you so much for chatting to me. I'm going to jump straight in. In less than a decade, South Africa has had at least 3 cases where the gay panic defense reared its ugly head in varying degrees of success. How prevalent in general society is the mindset that a gay man who comes onto a straight man deserves what's coming to him?
Well, I definitely have to say that I don't think that that should be any kind of precedent in South Africa at all. And in fact, the term gay panic in South Africa is not necessarily legally recognized. I know that in a lot of international countries, there have been cases where that term has been coined. But here in South Africa, activists are actually steering away from this notion of a gay panic defense because it doesn't hold precedent in our country. Okay. I would also like to say that, violence shouldn't be the answer to any kind of violation experienced by anyone, and that if we start implementing ideas like that, it's definitely dangerous in relation to a country like South Africa, because with high prevalence of sexual and gender-based violence experienced by women, the argument then could go the other way, that any woman that is assaulted or sexually violated could act in the same manner on the basis of this argument.
Yes. Okay, you say there's no precedent set. A lot of countries have actually introduced legislation to stop the gay panic defense from being used. Like, I think it is the UK and New Zealand, some states in America. Is South Africa considering actually legislating that this defense can't legally be used?
Well, not as yet. So as I mentioned, the conversation is kind of geared toward not even accepting the term within South African legislation, but there's not really been an active, let's say, movement or kind of convening around the banning of this gay panic defense, because we just feel like it shouldn't exist in the country at all.
Okay.
So giving voice to that, and I suppose rallying behind banning it, opens a different kind of set of arguments, you know. So I think it's definitely something that we need to be cognizant in terms of our constitution, what our law says, what are the repercussions for murders, and also how this can also be seen as a hate crime.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, this week's episode deals with the murder of Siduduzu Buthelezi. I know that there were calls for the National Prosecuting Authority to appeal this judgment. Have there been any developments on that?
So, there were two processes that are ongoing. There is what we call the National Task Team that is situated in the Department of Justice, and they specifically deal with legislation in relation to LGBTI rights. And then furthermore, we also monitor hate crimes through this body. So it's basically a body that consists of civil society organizations, the National Prosecuting Authority, and then also the South African Police Services. And usually these services are, especially from the police and the NPA, is to help escalate cases in terms of hate crimes. Mm-hmm. So when this gay panic defense, and I'm saying that in inverted commas, came across the desk, obviously there was a great uproar by civil society to say that this was just a slap on the wrist for Nkosi Nadim Gladla, who had, you know, committed this murder. And the NPA, we then appealed to the NPA to then take it further and investigate, you know, as to what can be done. Can there be an appeal based on this case? And so far, the results have been that the NPA has come back and said that they do not see that there would be a success in appealing this. And so for that reason, they're not going to pursue it. So that is the current state of where things are at. They did, however, say that as civil society organizations, we can write to them and, you know, ask for further investigation and further information as to why they think that this is not worth an appeal, considering that someone had died and that the sentencing was basically community service and a suspended sentence. So that's where things are currently are at in terms of that specific ruling.
Okay. I want to move on to the reaction back then just after the court ruling. One commenter online at the time said that had it been a straight woman who had killed a straight man, the sentence would have been much harsher, primarily because it would have been a heterosexual crime. Do you agree with that?
I think it's definitely got to do with the judge who made the ruling. Because even through the court transcripts, the judge kind of was an apologist toward the person that had committed murder. He had said that this was a first offense, sending him to jail would just then also perpetuate further criminality. And the judge had also said that, you know, it was an animalistic response that was not necessarily done conscientiously with the intent to murder. And I definitely think if it was anybody except for a LGBTI individual on the receiving end of such a injustice, it would have been definitely there would have been greater consequences. But in general, in South Africa, in relation to crimes perpetuated against LGBTI people, we've always asked for harsher sentences to send the message to the public that this is against our constitution. We are not going to protect transphobes and homophobes. And so we also just need to get the courts in alignment in relation to that. There are a few other cases that I've seen where judges have made exceptionally great choices in rulings. I'd even give an example of the court case that happened recently in KZN with Linda Kuchle-Trele, who was stabbed 23 times in broad daylight. And yesterday the sentence was 25 years to the perpetrator of that crime. And the perpetrator of that crime had also, allegedly had said that he responded in that way, in stabbing Linda Kuchle, because Linda Kuchle had sexually assaulted him. So in essence, it's also kind of framing it in that gay panic, framework. But obviously this didn't happen immediately. This happened after this person had alleged that they had been sexually violated. But, you know, I think it's definitely dependent on that judge's decision. And I do want to say that sometimes our courts do make great decisions in relation to LGBTI crimes and ensure that people are actually held accountable for perpetuating violences.
Okay, well, that actually leads on to my next question. To what extent do you feel that the justice system in South Africa is prejudiced against the LGBTQ community due to the personal opinions of judges presiding over the cases?
So it's very interesting because as much as the courts are supposed to be, you know, the champions of justice in our country, often you would find that judges have little to no expertise or knowledge on LGBTI issues. And that is highly problematic. I remember I had one trained a group of magistrates and, introduced the concept of pronouns to them. And they were so surprised by this, right? Because also a lot of the time they use gender neutral terms in court, like the perpetrator and the victim and the assailant. But nonetheless, it's also definitely a problem with our education system in general in South Africa. And a lot of the time I do feel and I empathize with people who haven't been exposed to this kind of knowledge, because realistically in our schools, we don't really speak to this in a very comprehensive way. There has been, attempts by the Department of Basic Education to now include comprehensive sexual education, but that came with such major pushback from the public as well. And, if you don't learn it in school and you go to university and it's not a particular course or a module in what you are undertaking, how else are you supposed to kind of understand these concepts and the diversity of sexual orientation and gender identity? Seldomly people do. And that in effect then goes to the workplace where people are discriminatory. So I wouldn't say that the courts are any different from any kind of discriminatory practices in labor. But I definitely think that there needs to be a greater attempt in sensitizing magistrates, in sensitizing people who preside over cases, so that they can use the correct terminology and that they're also sensitive to the issues of LGBTI people who have a very specific set of, hindrances and challenges that they are faced with.
Yeah. How concerned should the community be about a judgment like what Madlala got, that it sets a precedent for future cases?
Yeah, and so I think that's why we definitely can't allow that to happen. And there are some processes that are underway to ensure that we ask the questions in relation to the NPA and we constantly put pressure on them, because this is exactly what happens in terms of cases. It does set a precedent, and then once you have that precedent, everything, it gives permission essentially for people to say, oh, but look at this case, this person wasn't sentenced as well. And when people come across cases like this, sometimes they'll use it and abuse it actually to their advantage to be the more transphobic or homophobic, knowing that they could possibly get away with this crime. So I think there's other things that also need to be taken into account here, though, that there are structures that are consistently also monitoring hate crimes, like I mentioned, the National Task Team. And there's also the Hate Crime Working Group. And through these bodies, we also push for accountability. But what would really help in South Africa would be the introduction of the Hate Crime and Hate Speech Bill, which has been pending now for 10 years. And so,
wow.
Yeah, it's been a while. And so we also kind of rallying to have that bill be put that it becomes part of legislation, because that will essentially then ensure that LGBTI people are protected in relation to hate crimes. Because currently you can't go to a police station and say, I'm going to report a hate crime. The police will look at you and ask you, what is a hate crime? Because that specific way of let's say, approaching cases doesn't exist in South Africa. So it's very, yeah, when people do report, they have to be very specific about the language that was used during the violation. Were they called anything? Were they being, was there any kind of language used that was gendered to insinuate the attack happened because they were either, for instance, because of their sexual orientation or their gender identity? So that's kind of how things are measured at the moment. But we definitely need the legislation to ensure that incidences like this don't fall through the cracks and that, you know, people are held accountable.
Yes, yes. One thing I also want to ask on this topic. Transgender people are an especially vulnerable group, and the South African mindset is often greatly influenced by the policies and viewpoints of countries like America and the UK. With the current climate of trans discrimination being experienced in these countries specifically, and being disseminated by celebrities like J.K. Rowling, what kind of sensitivity training or education is being given to the police and the judiciary regarding trans rights in particular? And LGBTQ rights in general?
So on that body that I mentioned, the National Task Team, there was a national rollout on sensitization training that had happened. And the idea was to train the trainer, and specifically for service providers that work at state departments, and then also NGOs that may have contact with LGBTI people. And so this national rollout was in essence gender sensitization, so unpacking the SOGI-ESC acronym, unpacking what LGBTI stands for. But we also gave them some scope into, some insight into hate crimes. We also then provided pieces of legislation that, and, you know, kind of drafts of legislation that protect LGBTI people in terms of service provision. And so within those trainings, there were a lot of police people present, but it was difficult to monitor whether they had actually gone back to their own stations and then trained the colleagues or, you know, superiors or subordinates. And further than that, the police does currently have a standard operating procedure document in place in relation to LGBTI people. So this is also very questionable as to who has been trained in relation to that SOP. Do new recruits get trained when they join the police force? How is that monitored in terms of if the information has actually been impactful in their understanding? And so those are the two things from a collective collective effort from civil society, but I know a lot of organizations also do trainings and they do educate not only, you know, government structures, but also trans individuals about their rights and What is accessible to them in terms of empowerment, and what legislation protects them? And I think also with a lot of the bills that have currently come out, there's a greater call and a recognition from our government that that trans rights need to be amplified in the country. We are specifically talking about things like the introduction of the identity management policy by Home Affairs, where there was a call in relation to adding an X instead of just the F and M sex descriptors on ID numbers. And then, of course, activists had also asked for other things, that, you know, your ID number shouldn't be gendered, because it was, well, gendered, I say gendered in inverted commas. It shouldn't be gendered because it has no bearing on, you know, it just shouldn't exist. And then also there was also a call that the F and M not be included on the actual ID document, because this information currently already resides within the population register. And I think there was also an ask in relation to the repeal of Act 49, which deals with legal gender recognition. And so the processes currently for trans people are very difficult, because it in essence, kind of pathologizes trans individuals, where they have to go on hormone replacement therapy to then change their sex descriptor. So a lot of these processes are happening at the moment. And I think there is a political will from various government departments to change legislation and to make policies more inclusive. The difficulty, however, is that these things do take time. And so the processes involved in Parliament, the voting of the bills, the open commentary from the public, then it moves to the NCOP, and then finally, if it is instated, it goes to the National Assembly. So these processes do take some time, and you know, they don't work, they don't happen overnight. But they shouldn't also take as long as the hate crime and hate speech bill has taken. Yeah. So I think there are a lot of things that are happening in terms of trans awareness, and but I think one of the key things that I'll mention again is I think there needs to be a measure of inclusion in our education system, because that is where you learn first, you know. And if we can start at a young age to educate South Africans and young people, this becomes part of our daily knowledge. It's not something that seems foreign. It's not like a difficult thing to understand. And I think there definitely has to be more emphasis on education around the diversity of sexual orientation and gender identity.
Mm-hmm. And what can the queer community do to help the process along?
I think this is a difficult question, because I think a lot of queer individuals feel like the onus is always on them to educate the general population, and that can be exceptionally tiring. I mean, in one, if you are queer identifying, the chances are you would have been discriminated against at least like 1 to 5 times just on a daily basis, you know, sometimes based on your sexual orientation or gender identity. But I think what is important, in my opinion, is as much as we do call out, we do need to call in as well. And where you can offer information, offer clarity, instead of being overtly defensive and just shunning the person out. Because we do also want to create a culture where it doesn't seem intimidating to ask these questions. But I would say that I know a lot of queer people feel like they're always and consistently doing this work, and it's not their job. And I would agree to a certain degree and say that, you know, the structures that we have in place in South Africa should be taking care of educating our wider population, and that we need to steer, as much as people have rights to cultural beliefs and religious beliefs, we also need to amplify queer visibility through education. And I don't think that that's necessarily always the queer person's job to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. I really do appreciate it. And yeah, I feel this is a vitally important topic.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I would just like to also just convey that we have a few offices around the country. So in essence, OUT has two programs. One is the Love Not Hate program that deals specifically with hate crimes and then also non-lethal violations. And if people are interested in reporting hate crimes, they can do so at our Pretoria office. I can just give you the number, 012-430-3272. And then further than that, we also offer clinical services in our Pretoria site, at our site in Melville at 27 Boxes. We've got a site in Buffalo City in the Eastern Cape, and then also in Nelson Mandela Bay, where people can come and get tested for HIV. They can get initiated on ART treatment or on PrEP. And our services are completely free. And so we would encourage anybody, even if someone's listening out there and they may be in need of training, we do that as well. So just to be aware of the offices, that the services that we offer here at OUT.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
If you missed the contact details for OUT, I have included them in the show notes. Thank you for joining me for this final episode on Gay Panic, and I want to thank Roche Kester for taking the time to speak to me. If you have any feedback that you'd like to give me on the new interview segment, or you have a story that you want me to cover, please join the Facebook group or hit me up on Twitter. You'll find links to our social media in the show notes. I'll be back again next time, where we'll be exploring another brutal attack on a member of the South African queer community that definitely qualifies as a crime most queer.
You've been listening to A Crime Most Queer, an LGBTQ true crime podcast based in Johannesburg, South Africa. Presented by VA Amazing and written and produced by NJ Hawkerby and Janine McLean. With editorial oversight by Richard Thompson, original music by Joseph McDade, and additional voice talent by Janine McLean and others. See our show notes for more info. A Cry Most Queer is available on most podcasting platforms, including Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and others. Remember to subscribe on your podcast app of choice to be notified when we release new episodes. And if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, be sure to give us a rating and leave us a review. We really do appreciate hearing from you. If you would like to support the show, you can become a patron from just $1 per month by going to patreon.com/ACMQ podcast or make a one-off donation at paypal.me/ACMQ pod. We post all episodes along with additional content to our website, www.acmq.co.za. You can find us on social media by searching for A Crime Most Queer on Facebook and Twitter. We also welcome your thoughts either on social media, or you can email us at comment@acmq.co.za. While this story is based on actual events, some situations, conversations, and characterizations may have been fictionalized or invented for purposes of dramatization, based on court documents and press reports from the time. With respect to such fictionalizations, any familiarity to actual character or history of any person, living or dead, is purely for dramatic purposes. Some names may have been changed to protect the identity of those involved.